good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, July 13, 2017. President Salva Kiir fires judges who went on strike in May.
The decision also has serious implication for the government because the government has to train new judges, which is so costly. So finding new judges to replace the sacked ones is actually going to be a very difficult issue.
And the head of JMAC admits he's failed to end the fighting between government and rebels, but refuses to step down.
If that failure then results in my being discredited, so be it. I would say I've done my best, I failed, and that it was worth trying. Peace and saving lives is worth trying to risking your reputation for.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese legal expert says President Salva Kiir's decision to fire more than a dozen judges around the country undermines the independence of the judiciary. There are only 274 judges working across the entire country. The striking judges were demanding better pay and improved working conditions. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei told the South Sudan in Focus the judges were sacked by presidential order in an announcement read on South Sudan Broadcasting Television last night. Local media reports say some senior judges were among those let go. Makuei could not explain why the judges were sacked at the time when the government is expected to address citizen grievances in a national dialogue. Khalid Abdallah Mohammed, chairman of the Judges and Justices Committee, confirmed to South Sudan in Focus that he and several other judges were dismissed but declined to elaborate. Repeated phone calls made to the office of the president were not answered. South Sudanese legal expert Modi Ezekiel says the move undermines the independence of the country's judiciary system.
The judges may not feel free to utter out their views because they fear the executive will sack them. So they will be working according to the wills of the executive. Yet an independent judiciary is very crucial for any country that wants to build a better future.
Ezekiel says, like many others, he was surprised by the president's decision to fire the judges, especially at a time when the judiciary is extremely understaffed. He says sacking the judges will increase the workload on the few remaining judges who are working across the country.
Because first of all, the country has been faced with shortage of judges right from its independence up to now. Some judges died, they were never replaced. Others ran out of the country due to the insecurity, they have never been replaced. While the young generation are not willing to join the judiciary because of the low pay. The decision also has serious implication for the government because the government has to train new judges, which is so costly.
Ezekiel says the notion of firing judges should first have been addressed by the South Sudan's Judicial Service Commission. The judges' strike began on May 1st after the government failed to address their grievances. Besides calling on the government to increase their pay and improve their working conditions, they asked President Kiir to sack Chief Justice Chanarich Madut, who the judges said was not responding to their concerns. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, known as JMAC, which is tasked with monitoring the implementation of South Sudan's 2015 peace agreement, admits for the first time he has failed to stop the fighting between government forces and rebels loyal to former first vice president Riek Machar. Festus Mohai says reviving the deal is the only way to end the fighting. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
At a Juba news conference today, JMAC chairman Festus Mohai said since the peace deal was signed 2 years ago, there have been more armed groups fighting and more people have been either displaced internally or have sought refuge in neighboring countries.
We have made not enough progress so far as the stopping the fighting is concerned. as a South Sudanese, are you not aware of that? I understand them because I know these things are happening.
Mohai, the former president of Botswana, says clearly peace has not been achieved in South Sudan. According to the signed agreement, peace means restoring a permanent ceasefire. Mohai says the rebels allied to Machar have asked him to declare the peace agreement dead so that the regional bloc, Intergovernmental Authority on Development or IGAD, will initiate a new political process outside of South Sudan. But Mohai believes the peace deal can still be revitalized.
It's alive, but wounded. It's imperfect. That's why we are revitalizing it. If it was dead, we would be resurrecting it. So because it's not dead, we are not resurrecting it. We are revitalizing it.
Mohai says he is aware that many South Sudanese are unhappy with his performance as JEMEC chief. He confirms that the SPLM-SPLA-IO faction allied to Machar recently called for his resignation, but says he has no plans to step down.
I will do my best. If I fail, I'll fail. If that failure then results in my being discredited, so be it. I would say I've done my best, I failed, and that it was worth time. Peace and saving lives is worth trying to risking your reputation for. That's why many of us are here for.
Mohai says IGAD has so far not responded to the SPLA-IO's request for him to resign or to declare the peace deal dead. He says he plans to organize a high-level forum to talk about resuscitating the peace agreement, and IGAD will identify groups to be included in the forum. Mohai says IGAD will probably not exclude Machar's group because it was a major party to the agreement.
The main ones was the government, led by the president, His Excellency the President, and the opposition, led by the former first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar. Then there was the former detainees and other political parties and so on. There were the signatories to the agreement. But there are other South Sudanese who were not signatories to the agreement. So presumably they would be included, I think. Because now new groups have emerged.
Mohai says the peace deal's revitalization plan will likely be implemented within 3 months after it begins. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A South Sudanese analyst and a researcher with the Juba-based SAD Institute says people in South Sudan have lost confidence in the government but are too afraid to stage a protest. Jock Madud Jock says the views expressed by the head of JEMEC is not new to South Sudanese. Jock says the economic crisis has taken its toll on the majority of South Sudanese citizens.
There is no question anymore that the government of South Sudan is no longer capable of providing protection, basic needs of the people, and that the people have now become frustrated with the way the state is being run. Not only has violence spread furthermore, not only are people desperate for basic requirements on a daily basis to keep themselves alive, more importantly, there is no clear path for the future and what is going to happen in the next few months, not to speak of the next year.
Today, the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, former Botswanan President Festus Mohai, said in a press briefing that the peace agreement is wounded. These are his words. The peace agreement is wounded and that JEMEC has failed to stop the two parties from fighting. What is your assessment of the work of JEMEC in South Sudan? They have been making these statements on and on, saying the peace agreement is not dead, it's only wounded. What is your assessment of the peace agreement, its implementation?
This is a statement that he made today is simply stating what South Sudanese have been saying, that IGAD has failed. The process is no longer viable. Second thing that we can say about this conclusion is that all other projects, such as the national dialogue, that were tailored to the peace agreement and its implementation, are not longer viable. They are now in question. And the benefit of the doubt that some citizens were given to the government of President Kiir and his vice president Taban is now squashed. And so what this conclusion means is that even though IGAD and JEMAC have been saying that they don't want to renegotiate the agreement, we don't see any other way out, any way forward from now.
What is the alternative to this agreement? If this agreement is wounded, using Mohai's words, what is the alternative to it?
I think the country has to go to the drawing board to start anew, either to fill in the gaps of this wounded agreement, so-called, or to renegotiate a whole different agreement, particularly the issue regarding security arrangement. I mean, the security arrangement aspect of ARCIS is really what can either make it or kill it. And so we can no longer keep trying to patch over some of the weaknesses of ARCIS. It has to be an overhaul.
President Kiir's statement on the 6th anniversary of the country's independence, he gave a list of what the government has implemented. He said the challenges in the cantonment areas, they're saying they don't have money for the cantonment areas. If I may ask, which troops are being cantoned?
That is the question, because the president and the government's partner in the peace agreement, which is SPLA-IO, does not have troops that can be cantoned. At least the part of the IO that is now partner in the government does not have troops to be cantoned. All the other armed groups that were not part of the agreement are not going to be cantoned because they don't have any agreement with the government. So on what basis do you canton them? So that is not an issue anymore. The real issue at the moment is that there is no peace agreement in place, and that this peace agreement that they are now trying to continue to insist and on implementing is hollowed out. So new thinking has to come. I think this concerns everybody, from the ordinary citizens of the country to the government to the opposition to the donors to the IGAD partners and so forth. All of them, there has to be a new thinking.
Talking about the armed groups, there are reports coming from South Sudan, and I've seen some pictures on the social media of a new group in northern Bahr al-Ghazal, Awil area specifically. Do you know anything about this new group?
The new group led by the son of Abdel Baghi Ayi, this is not a group that can be taken seriously in terms of its ability to actually challenge the government. But it is a sign of a possibility of collapse of the state from the seams, from all corners of it. So whether they are capable of defeating the government or not, that is not the issue. The issue is that people are unhappy all around the country.
I've been getting difficulties, you know, talking to people from Juba to get their independent, balanced and objective assessment of the situation in the country, because most people are afraid to speak. Now that you're coming from Juba, could you give us your, you know, objective, balanced and independent opinion of what is going on in Juba right now? Are people happy? Are people really happy with the status quo?
I would say categorically no, that people are afraid, people are hungry, people have almost lost any sense of hope for positive change emerging from these circumstances, from this government particularly leading the way. And so I would say if people were allowed to speak openly in the country, they would say that President Kiir and Vice President Taban and Vice President IGAD and their parliament have reached the end of the road with their capacity to run this country. So what gives? I think this is what people would say. There is total frustration all around. The problem is that the people of South Sudan do not have the capacity to stage a protest together across ethnic or regional lines.
That is Jock Madud Jock, researcher and co-founder of the Juba-based Saad Institute. He was speaking with me from Washington earlier today, where he is attending an advocacy meeting. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a Kenyan charity tries to prevent bloodshed leading up to the next month's election. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today
What is easier to solve? Money problems or love problems? And why?
I think money. Because for money, maybe you can think of what to do and you get it, then you can get some money. But relationship, I don't think so.
According to me, I think I can solve love problems. But money, without money, right now, these days, even love is almost bought. You know, you should have money to please someone that you love.
As long as it is called a problem. You know, problems are very many in this world. And the only easy way to solve them, however much they can be, is to forgive.
To solve money problem, it's for someone to get a job, to be employed. Love problem, it's only one way that you can solve it, understanding each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A Kenyan charity is working to prevent violence as the country goes to polls in August. The Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded in response to post-election violence in 2007. The group empowers communities in volatile regions to keep peace and encourage warring groups to lay down their arms. Reverend Father Patrick Devane is the founder of the Shalom Center. VOA's Ruben Chama asked him how the idea started.
Well, I first came to Africa in 1988. An Irish man, an Irish missionary, and began working in Western Tanzania. In the course of the last 29 years, I've had many, many different experiences in the realm of peace and development. When I look back on issues of conflict in Africa, I was particularly touched by the conflict that happened in Rwanda in 1994 and the disastrous impact that had on the people there and on the country and on the social, political, economic prosperity of the people. Then in my own career, I have ended up in a lot of roles of administration through the Religious Superiors Conference of Kenya, which would have been made up of approximately 5,000 personnel spread all over Eastern Africa. And during my time in that role as chairman and as the chief executive, the secretary general, I became aware of many, many conflict environments where people were killed and maimed and displaced persistently. And I looked at the role of the church and a lot of NGOs, and predominantly, they were very, very good at addressing the symptoms of conflict, the symptoms of poverty, the symptoms of migration. But very few had the skill sets or the qualifications to address the underlying causes. And I began to ask myself, after around 25 years working here, engaged in development projects, water, schools, hospitals, etc., did I wish to spend another 25 years just dealing with the symptoms, or did I really want to tackle the underlying causes? And it was out of that mindset that the Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded.
Could you give us some of these underlying factors, economic, historical, and maybe religious, that, for example, have influenced the solution one of the conflicts your group is actually addressing?
Take, for example, in the northern Kenya, in the area where Kenya interfaces with Somalia, Ethiopia, South Sudan and Uganda. Some of the key problems causing interethnic conflict are around the following issues. Of course, core resources, which is really to do with environmental resources. Not just their scarcity, but also the management of what they have. Second, in some of the conflicts, you have issues of cultural variation. Different cultures and different issues creating clashes between the people based on their own cultural traditions. Thirdly, you have contested territory, customary land mostly, contested territory about access to water and pasture. Fourthly is the whole area of infrastructure insecurity, the lack of institutions in terms of roads, communications, law and order, legal redress, medical education, all of these things which are crucial to help people to meet their basic human needs and to actualize their potential. And you put all that into a boiling pot together, you get a social pressure cooker, right, generating conflict. And that also is contaminated by the proliferation of small arms. So there's not one monocausal explanation. It's a multiplicity and it needs a multidisciplinary approach. And that's why Shalom has people with qualifications from many disciplines who are committed to working persistently inside in the conflict environment.
Kenya is gearing up for another election next month. Could you share with us some of the initiatives as Kenya heads for the next election?
apart from working up in this northern area of Kenya and where it interfaces with the surrounding countries, we're also very, very involved in the slum areas, the poor areas of urban cities here, particularly in Nairobi, Kibera, Matare, Kariobangi area, also in Nakuru, Naivasha, places where were the hot spots of conflict. Back in, 2008, we had over 1,250 people killed in the post-election violence, 60,000 maimed, and over a half a million displaced. Coming up to these elections, now we have completed over 60 workshops right across all those hotspots. So what are we really focusing on is preparing the influential opinion shapers in those environments with the skill sets, right, to analyse what has caused conflict in the past and what can be, in terms of structures and institutions, improved to ensure that violence doesn't happen in the upcoming elections. So we go in there, we're training them people, and we're also helping them to devise action plans. It's their community and they have an obligation and they have a right to ensure that all the institutions are in place in terms of election preparedness for the prevention of election violence and to ensure that we have fair and just elections.
That was Father Patrick Levine, the founder of Shalom Center, speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi. Still in Kenya, Kenya is less than a month from a nationwide voting and Electoral Commission remains under pressure. The opposition is preparing to take the commission to court. The voter registry continues to spark debate among Kenyans. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
When Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission opened a short message platform 2 weeks ago so the public could check voter details, many, like Florence, a businesswoman, used it and found her details were correct, but not those of her sibling. She says her sister checked her details and found her identification number was registered to another person and she was a registered voter in Kiambu, Gatundu East, while she is a registered voter at Buruburu in Nairobi. She went to where she registered as a voter and they put her name back. She was furious. Many Kenyans sent random numbers or incomplete digits, but they were still registered, raising questions on the credibility of the register. Electoral Body Commissioner Roslyn Akombe defended her organisation.
What we have seen is that in a majority of those cases, people are putting in maybe their correct national ID numbers, but that's not probably what we have in the system, because maybe a number has been transposed. And so when they try to put in the information, it doesn't come out. But it does not mean that they are not in the register.
The audit firm KPMG, which was hired to clean the register, found 90,000 dead voters on the rolls and another 500,000 people who used wrong or inconsistent ID numbers. The electoral body says it has removed at least 88,000 dead voters from the list. Florist Simon Musungu says the voter register must be published. The register should be published so that everyone can verify their details. That will benefit the IBC too. They cannot know everything. There is a problem because one vote matters. Even if one person does not vote, you deny him his rights. The Electoral Commission and the opposition have been battling in the courts on matters dealing the cancellation of the presidential ballot papers by the High Court. The Electoral Commission is appealing that decision. The opposition is asking the court to rule on what means of ballot counting and transmitting the results should be used. In December, the Parliament passed a law allowing the IBC to use manual voting and transmission in case the electronic technology fails. The head of the Electoral Law and Governance Institute in Africa, Felix Odhiambo, says the failures of the past are haunting the commission.
IBC is yet to demonstrate that technology will work. Remember, in 2013, despite the assurances by the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, the technology failed. So as we speak, the Elections Act talks of technology to be put in place 60 days to the elections, tested, and its workability has attained. But as we speak, the IBC has not contested these gadgets. So the opinion is still divided as to whether they'll work or not.
Political observers predict a close contest between the incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Many hope the August 8th elections will be free, fair and credible to avoid violence similar to that in 2008. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report by the World Health Organization and the UN Children's Fund finds more than 2 billion people lack access to safe drinking water. More than twice that number, or 4.5 billion people, lack safe sanitation. The report is the first global assessment of water sanitation and hygiene for the Sustainable Development Goals. VOA's Lisa Schlein has more from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The United Nations reports nearly 850,000 people die every year from lack of access to good water, sanitation, and hygiene. This includes more than 360,000 children under age 5 who die from diarrhea and many others from diseases such as cholera, dysentery, hepatitis A, and typhoid. The joint report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund finds people living in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia are most at risk of disease and death from poor water and sanitation-related sources. WHO Coordinator for Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene, Bruce Gordon, says this report is the first to assess the importance of hygiene to good health. He says many homes, healthcare facilities, and schools have no soap and water for hand washing.
The one figure I'd like to kind of emphasize here is that in sub-Saharan Africa, 15% of the population only has access to a hand washing facility with soap and water. And as we know, good hygiene is one of the simplest and most effective ways to stop the spread of disease.
One of the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals calls for universal and equitable access to safe water and sanitation for all by 2030. UNICEF Chief of Water, Sanitation and Hygiene, Sanjay Wijsekera, says such progress would have a knock-on effect on other development areas.
For children, access to safe water, sanitation and hygiene not only keeps them alive and healthy, but it gives them a chance to go to school and gain an education, reduces inequalities, and it just gives them a fair start to life.
The SDGs are calling for an end to open defecation, which perpetuates a vicious cycle of disease and poverty. Open defecation is practiced by more than 890 million people, mainly in rural areas, who have no toilet or latrine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song No More War by Russ Corby.
Just checking up the global scene all over the world right now, seeing Rasta cities. We need a global love, you know, and a global solution, and must be a conclusion. Sure, Rastafari, just stop the war. No more war in Africa, the people gotta leave up to Jah. No more war in the Middle East, the people are fighting the peace. No more war in America, the people gotta live up to Jah. No more war in Asia, we gotta keep it nice and neat, y'all. Our people suffering around the world today, they're trying to find a solution. We look around and nowhere to hide, not even a single place to run. How can you say you're leading the world? That love. So how can you say you're leading the world without peace? Circumstances meet people along the way, they need someone to turn to. Only Jah has the solution, no mankind has it on his own. We were creating the image and the likeness of Jah. Mankind, don't try to fool yourself.
We have been listening to Russ Corby with the song No More War. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. If you like what you're hearing or if you don't like it, please drop us a line. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. That's southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us out on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Asia.
We gotta keep it nice and neat. Can't you tell me how much love you have for this world?